Accuracy errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, AFGE National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals Chairman Stan Painter details a proposed change to poultry inspections at the Food Safety and Inspection Service. And Defense Conference Chair Don Hale and Vice Chair Patty Viers discuss cutbacks at DOD. Then we'll learn about the AFGE Nurses Steering Committee with members Lisa Hartman and Shiloh Schalk. But first, First Command Financial Services District Advisor Bob Hill joins us to discuss the new Roth option in the Thrift Savings Plan. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jason. Glad to be here.
So as we mentioned, there is a proposed change coming to the Thrift Savings Plan to include the new Roth option. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you're exactly right. There's a lot of excitement regarding the new opportunity federal employees and military professionals will have to contribute to their Thrift Savings Plan account using a new way of doing it. As you well know, currently when a person contributes to TSP, the dollars that they put into the account are pre-tax. So it reduces the tax, it reduces their taxable exposure, how much they're paying in tax. And that's great, and it has been a wonderful way for federal employees to contribute money into their accounts. The money grows in the account income tax-free, and when they pull the money out of the account, all of those dollars, the growth of their dollars, and the contribution that the federal government has made for them, assuming that they're FERS employees, will be taxed as ordinary income. TSP has announced that in the April through June timeframe, they will offer the TSP Roth option. So the dollars that are being contributed to TSP, should a federal employee elect the option, will go in and they'll be taxed before the dollars go into the account. But they'll grow in the account with any without any taxes being due. And all the money that they have put into the account and all the growth of the investment will come out income tax-free. And that's exciting.
And so in a simplified way, you can either choose to pay the taxes now or you can choose to pay the taxes on the money later at the end when you start drawing out of the account. How does one determine which option is best?
The TSP board has said that they're going to recommend that federal employees consult a financial advisor before making a decision whether or not they'll participate in the TSP Roth. And I think that's a great idea because it's not for everyone. But I think there are four groups of individuals who are able to participate in TSP who should consider the Roth option. The first group is younger workers. Individuals who are more concerned about putting money aside for their retirement than they are about paying taxes now. And I'll give you a quick example how this might work. Let's assume that you're a younger federal employee and you're contributing a total of $5,000 a year into your thrift savings plan, which would be about $190 a pay period. You consistently do that over your full federal career of 30 years. And assume that the investment that you're contributing to makes 7% rate of return. Now, I can't promise that, but that's a reasonable expectation for a long-term investment. If someone were able to do that, they would, at the end of 30 years, Jason, have over $500,000 in their thrift savings plan account that would be income tax-free. In other words, they could spend all the money and never pay taxes on it. That's exciting and an opportunity that younger feds may want to consider. The second group of individuals who will want to consider TSP Roth are military members. And I know many of your listeners have loved ones, family members, and friends who are in the military and are still deploying to combat zones. So when a military member is in a combat zone, their income is income tax-free. So here's an opportunity to put money into an account, the TSP Roth, that they haven't paid tax on in the first place. All the dollars will grow income tax-free, and again, when they pull the money out, typically at age 59 and a half and older, all of those dollars will come out income tax-free. The best deal in town. The third group of people who might benefit from this type of approach are individuals who have more complicated tax situations and are looking for tax diversification, and that might be at the recommendation of their financial advisor or CPA, because they probably have a higher income, and they want to have some money where they're paying taxes now, some money where they're paying taxes later. And again, this could be part of their overall investment portfolio that allows them to have money later in life that won't be taxed. And the fourth group of people who might benefit from this type of approach are feds who think they will be in a higher tax bracket when they retire. That might be because they've sold property and will have a higher income. It could be because they think they're going to have generous pensions or annuities, or they might have an inheritance coming their way. So that a Roth option might be right for them also.
Is there any way for a person to predict their future tax liability falling into Category 4?
That's the great question, and one that I think is best answered by working with an advisor, because I think all of us understand that with all the pressures that the federal government has to meet all of its obligations, that it's only reasonable to think that taxes will go up in the future. And if they don't go up at the federal level, they'll certainly will at the state and local level. So the point being, if you have an opportunity to put money aside into an account that grows over time and will be available to you to use income tax-free, there's a lot of reasons why you should consider that opportunity.
And what about the particulars around passing that money on to somebody else through an inheritance or a will? Mm-hmm.
With the TSP Roth, one of the requirements of that account is that at age 70 and a half, you will start to have to take money out of the Roth account, just as you have to do with the regular pre-tax dollars that you're putting in now. So that is a requirement. At the same time, it's reasonable to think that those dollars could be passed on in inheritance or legacy to others, and again, those dollars would be income tax-free. So there are different ways to plan for that ability that a person would have to make sure that they really have left something behind to their relatives or friends or charity that would have an incredible impact on the future.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Bob Hill, District Advisor for First Command Financial Services. Bob, how have you and your colleagues at First Command handled this new option that the Thrift Savings Plan is offering?
We like to first ask what's important to you. In other words, we can assume that retirement income planning is most important to most Americans, and I think it's reasonable to think that's an incredibly important part of their overall financial planning needs. At the same time, as you well know, Jason, TSP by itself, whether it's in the regular TSP or a Roth option, really is not a way to put money aside for a child's education or to be able to do things that you want to while you're still in federal service. So it has to be looked at as a part of a financial plan and part of an investment strategy. And that, of course, ties into the other key parts of a financial plan, which include cash management, just making sure you have enough money for the rainy days of life, as well as making sure that you've taken care of risks.
How much should someone have in a rainy day fund versus what they're investing in some of these other vehicles?
Each person or family will determine that probably based on their experiences in life. For example, we typically talk about on a monthly basis putting approximately 5% of your dollars aside for the rainy days. Now, for a federal employee or military professional, that typically means 3 to 6 months worth of salary that's sitting aside in an account that is very liquid. In other words, you could reach out and use those dollars today if you needed to. So that is part of the plan. We talk about another 5% of your monthly dollars going into risk management, the different types of insurances that we all need. And then approximately 10% as an amount that would go toward long-term investments, whether that's TSP, individual retirement accounts, education accounts, or other accounts that for long-term goals.
What are some of the limits that people should be aware of when talking about their thrift savings plan versus IRAs, both traditional and Roth?
It's really important for you to know how much you can contribute. For example, this year, 2012, individuals who are under age 50 are allowed to contribute $17,000 to their thrift savings plan account. If they're 50 or older, then they can take advantage of what they call the catch-up provision, which allows them to contribute another $5,500 in the year. So that's a great way to right there to put $22,500 aside for your retirement. At the same time, all Americans have the opportunity to contribute to individual retirement accounts. And there, if you're under age 50, you have the opportunity to contribute $5,000 a year. Once you turn age 50 and older, then you can put another $1,000 in, again, that catch-up provision. So there's some real opportunities to contribute significant dollars toward your retirement. And I might add, you can certainly take advantage of the thrift savings plan Roth option and still have your own individual retirement account also in a Roth. So some great opportunities there.
When you talk to clients of First Command, what do you see as some of the biggest challenges federal employees face in planning their retirement?
I think the biggest challenge that we see in our office on a daily basis, Jason, is that individuals just don't know how much they'll need when they retire, and they're not comfortable in knowing when they'll be able to retire. First Command has a financial behaviors index that we've been conducting periodically since 2008. And we ask military professionals and we ask federal employees different questions about their attitudes and comfort level, if you will, regarding certain financial matters. In our most recent survey of federal employees, we learned that they are very pessimistic about their ability to retire comfortably. Only 21% of the respondents told us that they think they're in a position to do that. The point being is that they really are not confident that they have put enough money aside for the future. And they, I think, also don't really understand or know how much they need in order to live in a comfortable manner.
Is there a formula one could use to determine how much they might need in retirement?
Again, it will depend on their situation. If they're a single person, married, if they plan to live in the local community or move perhaps to another area that might be higher or lower cost, those are the kinds of considerations that take place. What type of lifestyle do they want to have when they retire? Do they want to fully retire or perhaps continue in the workforce in some capacity, either in consultant work or perhaps be an entrepreneur and start a new career? Those are the types of questions that have to be answered before we can give a specific answer to that type of question.
Bob, as you know, federal employees are currently under a two-year pay freeze. How has the pay freeze impacted federal employees' ability to save and prepare for their retirement?
Again, our behaviors index has pointed out that federal employees are taking some action on their own, Jason, and they're putting more money aside now than ever into long-term savings. That's what they're telling us. And they're also putting more money aside into their retirement accounts. So that is one of the outcomes of this uncertainty that they face, that now they're starting to take action. And that's why I think we're seeing a lot of individuals who really want to sit down with a professional and talk about where they are, their long-term goals, and how they can build a roadmap and develop a strategy so, in fact, they'll be able to do just that.
As you know, many employees currently in the federal government are nearing retirement age. What are some things that those employees should be on the lookout for as they near that retirement date?
I would recommend that all of them consider, either through their own agency, HR, to get a report as to what their benefits will look like at the time of retirement. And it's my understanding that agencies typically will do that for employees who are within 5 years of retirement. At the same time, we have a report, for example, that's called the Financial Freedom Report, that takes into account with some basic information to include their leave and earnings statement, their FEGLI election, FEHB election, as well as what they have in their thrift savings plan, and give them an idea as to what retirement will look like and the income they'll have at that time. And we can do some what-ifs in terms of what if you retire in 2013 or perhaps delay that by 1 or 2 years. The point being is that they need to have a snapshot as to what life after federal service looks like, taking into account taxes as well as the fact that costs such as FEHB are only going to go up in the future. So that's a starting point. And then they need to have a strategy to talk about how they really can set aside some dollars now. And even it's never too late, I might add. It's never too late to get started. So even if you're in within 5 years or less from retiring, put some money aside. And that could be by additional dollars in the thrift savings plan, additional savings, or retirement accounts.
Bob Hill, District Advisor for First Command Financial Services. Bob, thanks for coming to see us today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals Chairman Stan Painter details a proposed change to poultry inspections at the Food Safety and Inspection Service.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more. Visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined now by Stan Painter. Stan is the chairman of AFGE's National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals. Stan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stan, there is a proposal underway now at the Food Safety and Inspection Service to change the way young poultry is slaughtered in plants. Tell us about this proposal.
Yes, the proposal actually affects chickens and turkeys, and it's going to set a line speed of 175 birds per minute for one inspector sitting at the end of the line or standing positioned at the end of the line in order to inspect in poultry, and 55 for turkeys. And the organoleptic inspection that had previously been done by the government inspector is now being turned over to the plant. Previously, the line speeds were, you know, to where an inspector could inspect the outside and inside of the carcass at, you know, no more than 35 birds per minute. And, you know, we have concerns, and I think the consuming public would have concerns about the process by which their meat and poultry their poultry products, their turkey and chicken products, will now be inspected by plant employees.
Stan, you said that the proposal would increase the inspections to 175 birds per minute. What's the current rate of inspection?
Well, each inspector is responsible for 35 carcasses per minute under any inspection system that they have. You have one inspection line system called SIS that is 70 birds per minute total, with two line inspectors, you know, bringing the total to 35 each. Nails is a 91 line speed inspection and about 30 and a third. And then you have a couple of more systems, NewTek and Mine Maestro, which they can go up to 105 with three inspectors per line, and or 140 with four inspectors per line, still having the ratio at 35 carcasses per minute.
But this proposal says 175 birds per minute for one inspector who would be positioned at the end of the line. Is that correct?
Correct. And by the time that the carcass reaches the inspector, the organs, which is called the viscera, will be removed, and which is a vital indication of a number of diseases, you know, especially leukosis, which could result in complete and total condemnation of the viscera as well as the carcass itself. And now those things will be removed by the time that they reach the inspector. And under the current procedures, you know, you have spaces in between the carcasses. Actually, you know, there's like 6 inches. And now you're going to be having them literally touching wing to wing and at these tremendous line speeds.
Stan, 175 birds per minute seems like a lot to the average person listening. Is that right?
Well, it's a tremendous amount, and in some cases, it's going to, you know, more than double the amount of line speed. You know, if you're going 70, you know, even doubling that's 140, so you're going to more than double the line speed. And, you know, we have a number of concerns. Number one, you know, the inspector that's going to be at the end of the line and the responsibility of catching everything that the plant employees don't catch, and the ability to do that, as well as the safety factor. You know, most of the plants at the end of the line, when you have that station there, the inspector after the station, the line almost immediately starts an uphill climb, and you know, you get caught in the line, you know, you're the likelihood of losing fingers or getting drugged through the plant is a tremendous concern of ours.
So what are you and the council doing to fight back against this proposal?
Well, number one, we're trying to get the word out. You know, we're trying to get the word out to as many people as we can. I don't think the consuming public will be comfortable knowing that their product is inspected by the plants, and that we have an inspector, just one inspector, sitting at the line, and the agency calling that bird by bird inspection. The Poultry Products Inspection Act calls for bird-by-bird inspection, and now this is a reinterpretation of that bird-by-bird inspection when there's no real organoleptic inspection done on that bird. You know, we want that seal that's placed on your poultry products that you go to the grocery store to buy, that little dime-sized seal that says inspected by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We want that to mean something. We don't want that something as just window dressing to give people a good feeling or to give people a false sense that their product is what it currently is today.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Stan Painter, the chairman of AFGE's National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals. Stan, this seems like a very serious consumer-related issue. As you mentioned, things getting checked and processed and having a stamped seal of approval on it. Are you getting some support from other organizations behind this?
Well, we are. We're getting some support for a number of the consumer groups. A number of the consumer groups are having the same level of concern that we are. A number of the consumer groups have lost, children due to E. coli from eating, contaminated hamburgers and things of that nature. So, you know, those folks certainly understand the risk involved with our food supply. You know, it's not something that you want to tamper with. You know, it's not like a bad habit that we say we're going to stop. We can't just stop eating, and we certainly want to feel comfortable that the meat that we place in our on our plates to our children and to our elderly people and everyone in between is safe. It's something that we don't feel like should be tampered with. The agency is claiming through this proposal that 5,200 people a year there will be a reduction in sickness of 5,200 people per year, but yet there's no statistical data to back that up. And when I questioned the agency about this 5,200 illness reduction, and the agency says, well, we think. And, you know, I'm not comfortable with the agency's thought process in thinking that this will reduce the sickness of 5,200 people per year.
Stan, if we're not mistaken, back in 2001, there was a similar proposal on the table, but the Bush administration backed away from it. Why was that?
Well, the Bush administration actually looked at the process, from what I understood, and didn't think they had the support in order to do this. And I'm really surprised that this administration is moving forward with this process. I have my reasons for questioning what's going on, and I know the person that headed up the transition team actually supported this and was a previous administrator for FSIS and supported this even back in the 90s. This all goes back to the HACCP system, and HACCP is a hazard analysis and critical control point, which is supposed to turn things over to the plants, and plants are supposed to take control of their processes. And the agency continues to do things to prop up HACCP because it has not worked. It is just difficult for a company that has to make a profit then is going to regulate themselves.
And that, of course, is something that raises a red flag to you as a conflict of interest, right?
Oh, certainly. It certainly is a conflict of interest. And, you know, and if I'm a plan employee and I'm in the position of what they're calling sorting the bad carcasses out and the contaminated carcasses out, and my supervisor standing behind me shaking his or her head telling me no, I'm probably not going to do that, which, you know, now if they have no control over us, you know, we're guided by the regulations, we're guided by the Poultry Products Inspection Act, and, you know, we're independent. We're working for the consumer, and we're working for the government. We're not working for a corporation.
And ultimately, it sounds like the proposal would have more birds per minute coming on the line, but less objective eyes to look at those increase in birds. Is that right?
Absolutely. At the plant where I'm stationed, it's actually under this pilot project for this initiative that's about to go nationwide, and they have, where we had two people looking inside carcasses at 35 a minute, they have two people looking inside carcasses at 90 a minute.
Stan,
per person.
Talk about the importance of an inspector looking at every bird, regardless of its condition, not just birds that appear to be fine or may have been reprocessed or fixed from any damage.
Well, you know, it's important because, you know, a bird could look healthy and then you have a disease called leucosis. And leucosis could be even in the spleen, but it's systemic. That means, you know, it comes from the blood and it's all throughout the carcass. And therefore, that carcass should be it should be condemned. And, you know, to the inspector that has worked the lines for a number of years as we have and received the training that we've received, that's something that stands out to us. And you know, plant employees take people off the streets and bring them in. And, you know, their training is minuscule in comparison to what we've had throughout the years.
In addition to the conflict of interest that you mentioned, is there a concern about the adequate training of plant employees doing these inspections?
Well, without a doubt, there's a lot of questions about that. You know, I've witnessed myself putting them on the line half a day, you know, with a coworker, and then saying, you know, you're trained, and that's their level of training. There's no schooling, there's no, you know, no process like that. And in a lot of cases, the plants go to the prisons. They go to prisons, they go to county jails, and they get the prisoners and the people from the county jails, and in order to work their processing and their slaughter lines.
Stan, any word from Capitol Hill on this? Are they aware of some of these significant proposed changes in the food inspection?
They are. We've had some contacts with Senator Kristen Gillibrand, and she's actually called for GAO to look at this process. GAO has not looked at the process since 2001, and we applaud her for her efforts. But to my knowledge, at this point in time, she is the only one that has made an effort to stand back and look at this process again.
Stan Painter, chairman of AFGE's National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals. Stan, thank you for your time, and please come back and update us on this.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE Defense Conference Chair Don Hale and Vice Chair Patty Byers address cutbacks at the Department of Defense.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com, joined by our good friends Don Hale and Patty Byers. Don is the chair and Patty is the vice chair of DEF CON. Welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Jason.
Nice being here. Thank you.
Let's get down to business. What's happening at DOD these days? We know that you're facing some cuts and some struggles in the workplace. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I'll start out first of all by saying that Department of Defense had to come up with some efficiency several years ago. We went through the first wave, and quite frankly, it has hit the Army the hardest. Don actually works in the Army, so he can talk more about that. But we face more and more cuts that are really going to be quite devastating to the department.
As we draw back in Iraq and Afghanistan, we all know that we're going to have to take some reductions. We can deal with the reductions. It's how it's being done. You know, they're just arbitrarily eliminating positions. My position, for one, I no longer have a job. I've been in the same position for 18 years, and in the Department of Army said that it's an overhire position. So they're eliminating it. They're eliminating the majority of the jobs that they're eliminating are blue-collar jobs, and eventually they'll just contract that work out in order to accomplish the mission, which is a direct conflict with the Defense Efficiency Initiative. They weren't supposed to be able to use contractors to accomplish the mission that they were going to have to as a result of these cuts.
Have you gotten any explanation as to why this is happening, why the cuts are so arbitrary, why, in fact, you lost your job?
No, they're not providing us any answers. Their answer is simple. It's an overhire position. We no longer want to do it. In my particular job, what they have done is expand the scope of an existing contract to take over the work that I normally do.
How have you reacted to that? Obviously, this has affected you personally.
Well, you know, we're hopefully going to be able to place most of the individuals whose jobs are being eliminated. Me personally, I'm not playing their ridiculous game. I've refused to submit a resume into the system. I'm going to force them into doing a reduction in force. We have certain rights, seniority, veterans' preference, that need to be applied if we're going to do this fairly and equitably throughout the workforce. So I'm going to be the sacrificial lamb, and we'll see what happens. But I'm not going out without a fight, I can tell you that.
Do you anticipate any sort of dialogue with the Department of the Army anytime soon about this?
We've spoke on numerous occasions to the Department of Army about this. As a matter of fact, again, my biggest concern is the fact that they say that they're not going to have contractors come in and do the work, and yet, for instance, at West Point, we have 600,000 square feet of roofs with no roofers, you know, so it makes no sense. Last week, the rumor has it, it hasn't been official, is that IMCOM, which is a big Army command that took the brunt of these cuts, all blue-collar jobs, were told as a result of some meetings that we had with the Department of Army that they have to go back and revamp them cuts. How that's going to affect the people that have already been negatively affected hasn't been worked out. But if there's any good news and if there's any truth in that rumor, then we will have a more equitable distribution of the pain, I guess, for lack of a better word.
What's the impact on service delivery with these cuts?
Well, obviously, employees are going to have to do more with less. We're going to be asked to do more with less from now until the near future. And we understand cuts. I've been working for the government for 35 years. I worked during wartime. I've worked during non-wartime. But what we want the department to do is to follow their own rules. Don't contract out this work, or don't extend contracts to do work that federal employees can't do because you put an arbitrary cap on FTEs. Follow your rules. We will do more with less, but we still need employees. We still need government employees to do work that contractors are doing at a much higher cost than the federal employee.
Jason, it's pretty obvious to all of us what the game plan here is. AFGE, through its grassroots mobilization, effectively stopped A-76, and this is a backdoor way to eliminate the federal workforce and the contract assault. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what the hell they want to do here. It's pretty obvious to all of us that this is simply some backdoor excuse that they've come up with as another means of contracting our work out and giving the work to their big buddies.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Don Hale and Patty Viers of the Defense Conference. Don, as you know, AFGE, when the union fights back, it means business. We've seen that with A-76. We've seen that with NSPS. What do you expect from the union during this time?
Oh, I know what we're going to do, and we're gonna launch a massive grassroots mobilization and let them know that we're not going to put up with this. We will take our pain. We're Americans, and most of us are former military. Many of us are vets. We understand what the road is that lies ahead of us. But we're going to do this fairly, and we're going to make sure that they understand that we've got four sets of eyes on them. Actually, we're going to have tens of thousands of eyes on them.
Patty, Don made a great point about the grassroots movement that's coming, and AFGE is very unique in that regard. It's very much a grassroots movement. The members lead the charge. Talk about how important that is to have that grassroots movement to, in essence, make the change that's needed.
Well, one voice alone can't do it. Everybody's got to do it. We've got to find it with it, reach down deep and find it within ourselves. We also have to build coalitions with our central labor councils, our state feds, to get their help because, you know, they're fighting their struggles too, and we've been helping them. And that's how you get things done. It's going to be very important that each employee write down, you know, sign their name to a letter to their congressman or their senator, and make that phone call, because one of us alone doing it from, you know, West Point or Columbus, Ohio, just isn't going to get it done.
Don, you mentioned that you were in your position for 18 years. Patty, you had said that you've been working in federal service for 35 years. How does it make you two feel whenever you read and hear of these attacks on federal employees?
I feel sorry for the ones coming behind me. I'll carry their water. My dad was a civil servant, and I'm proud to be one, and he was proud to be one. But when you continue to come at us on our pensions, on our pay, our benefits, and our job security, it doesn't make an attractive job anymore. And it is a noble job. I was proud to raise my right hand and swear to the Constitution that I would uphold it. So, Don?
And you know what Patty just said, I think, touches the heart and soul of us as federal employees. We take that oath that we made very seriously. We're very proud of it, and to be treated like second-class citizens, you know, it's insulting, and you would think by now that these folks would realize that we're not going to back down. Now, as I said earlier, we stopped A-76. Nobody thought we'd stop NSPS, but we did. We know how to mobilize our people. We know how to excite our base, and we're going to excite our base.
And so this week, of course, is AFGE's annual legislative conference. Members are descending upon Capitol Hill to speak to their members of Congress, their senators. What are you expecting out of the week?
Well, I'm expecting 850 activists to put a lot of pressure on our Republicans, in particular, and those Democrats that aren't real happy with us, for lack of a better term. So, you know, there's two bills on the floor that are going to be voted on this week, and they all affect all federal employees, as a matter of fact, not just the DOD employees, with regard to our pensions. And we're going to have to fight this week.
This is a starting point. That's what this week is. And the importance of this week actually is next week. We need to carry this through, and we will. We're actually fortunate to be here this week with what Patty said, the upcoming independent votes in the House on these two ridiculous bills. But we need then to carry that momentum forward, and that's what our charge is to make sure that we've excited everybody enough that this is just the beginning this week, and they'll take that momentum home with them.
Earlier, Don, you had mentioned with the drawdown in Iraq, the drawdown in Afghanistan, that some cuts were to be expected, but it's the way that they're being done, this arbitrary fashion. Does management recognize those concerns on the part of the union?
They've been told what our concerns are. They just don't seem to care, you know. And a lot of this isn't being done at the installation level. Let's make that very clear. A lot of this is being driven by higher commands, because the people, the commanders at our installations understand that they're not going to be able to accomplish the mission with these cuts. They know that eventually they're going to have to break the law and hire contractors to get this work done. The mission is not going to go unaccomplished. You know that, and I know that.
How's the morale at DOD?
Quite frankly, and I can only speak for Columbus, Ohio, but I would say it's about the same everywhere. It's not good. I mean, we know that we're facing big, huge cuts, that we're going to be asked to do more with less, as I said earlier. So the older employees who've been through this before know that it's not a happy time to go through. All we ask is that, you know, and Don alluded to it, big armies up there making huge decisions. And one of the things they're trying to do is avoid a RIF because they know how expensive a RIF is. And so big army can go to Congress and say, I didn't have a RIF. I placed all my employees or they left. Then they look good. But the employees that leave are the ones that are pressured into leaving. They've got no other choice.
You know, I was asked that question by my garrison commander about 2 weeks ago. And I told him, I says, you know, the morale was low as we're going through these A-76 studies, when we've been going through privatization studies. But I have never, in the 16 years that I've been the local president at West Point, see employee morale as low as it is today, because there's nothing for us to fight for. Under A76, we knew if we had our act together, we were going to win, and we did win. With NSPS, we knew if we applied enough pressure to Congress, we would defeat NSPS. There are very little tools for us to use to fight this. So people are looking for direction. We're going to give them direction this week and in the future, and, you know, show them that if we fight, if we stick together and we fight, then the right outcome will come to us at the end of the day.
Shifting gears for a minute, President Obama had made labor management forums, partnerships, a priority in his administration. How's that going with you in DOD?
It's a dog and pony show, plain and simple. It's something to check the box. We're not talking about any important issues. It's a smokescreen to show the administration that they're complying with an executive order. There is no substance to anything. We're not even talking with decision makers at these things.
And so what can be done to change that? I mean, if it was done through an executive order, that should be enough, right?
Well, and what I want to add about this is that I think that commanders and people that are the decision makers are just marking time, waiting on an election, waiting on an executive order to go away. I don't know what we can do to put any fire under these people to involve us pre-decisionally. I really don't know if there is an answer to that. But what I do know is that the executive order is not going to go away anytime soon. So we need to get our commanders involved and make them talk about those things that they don't want to talk about pre-decisionally.
We need to start having our friends be our friends. They ask for our help. We give them our help. We're going to help them out again in November. Then, you know, they have to return the favor. They're the ones that made an executive order. Why aren't they enforcing it? You know, that's what we have to do. We have to hold our friends accountable.
Explain for the audience why it's so critical that the union is involved in the pre-decisional items.
If anybody knows how to do things efficiently, if anybody knows things that could help out in the future, it's employees. We're the ones doing the work. We don't want to engage in these conversations to be obstructionists. We want to engage in these conversations to help out what we're doing right now and to make sure that we have stuff set in stone that'll help us in the future. It should be a win-win situation for everybody. That was the purpose of the executive order.
Don Hale, Chair of DEFCON, Patty Vyers, Vice Chair, appreciate your time. Thank you, as always, for coming on the program.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about AFGE's Nurses Steering Committee with members Lisa Hartman and Shiloh Shalk.
Attention AFGE members, are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more, visit shoppurchasingpower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by two appointed representatives of AFGE's Nursing Steering Committee, Lisa Hartman from the 5th District and Shiloh Shalk from the 11th District. Welcome to the program. Shiloh, you're relatively new to the steering committee. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing on the committee.
Well, currently I am learning a lot. It's really amazing to be here with this group and see the issues that are across the country and realize that that's going on right in my facility as well, and that I'm new to this group, so having this experience and knowing that it's happening across the country is pretty amazing to me.
What did it mean for you to be appointed to the committee?
It's what I believe in as far as I want to see the people that I work with as well as myself in the future of our job security and job satisfaction, and also the care for the veterans as well progress in a positive direction.
Do you get a sense that the nurses that you represent, do they understand fully some of the things that are happening to them in the workplace?
Not fully. Not the nurses that I work with. And so I think any knowledge that I can gain and bring to my coworkers that will strengthen us as a unit and in resulting making a better place to work.
Lisa, I'm wondering if maybe you can give us a little background and some context about who the steering committee represents and some of the activities that you partake in.
The nurse steering committee, we first met in 2007. And we represent all federal nurses in the workforce, the VA nurses, Department of Defense, Bureau of Prisons nurses. We represent the RNs, the LPNs, and, of course, our nursing assistants or our health techs. Our goal is to improve the working conditions through legislative and political action, as well as educating our nurses and working on policies and procedures to help improve their working conditions. And also to preserve the collective bargaining rights of federal nurses. Title 38 in the VA, we do not have full collective bargaining rights. But our sister nurses and brother nurses of DOD and Department of Defense, BOP, Bureau of Prisons, they have full collective bargaining rights. They're under Title 5. And we believe that nurses are entitled to a workplace with respect, allowed us to use our professional judgment, autonomy, and have fairness in the workplace, and also to make changes in our environment that's going to benefit our patients, our communities, and protect ourselves. We work on a variety of issues each year. We have an agenda that we start with, and we follow up each year with what's being done. We each take assignments and research the laws. We research the regulations of our agencies, and then we bring them back to the nurse steering committee and work on the issues that we can improve.
You had mentioned that you represent nurses at the VA, DOD, as well as the Bureau of Prisons. How do some of those issues overlap one another? What are some similar issues that all of those nurses face?
I would say safe staffing level is one, as far as that goes.
Do you find that one common thread is that they're all significantly understaffed, and does that hinder their ability to do their jobs?
Yes, sir. We are very understaffed as nurses. The nurse-patient ratios need to be improved to make sure that we can care for our patients the way they need to be. Currently in the VA, the nurse can tell you have to take 10 patients, and there's nothing we can do about that. But however, a difference is, like in the Department of Justice, that nurse that is transporting a prisoner, she can say, no, that's too much. That's a difference, but at least they can say, no, I can't take these. Everybody has mandatory overtime. You know, and they use that instead of hiring enough nurses to take care of the patients, is to use the mandatory overtime.
Do you see that as something that could impact patient care in a negative way? If you're talking about making a nurse work longer hours than he or she should, if you've got a tired nurse working long hours?
Absolutely. First of all, the nurse has to be cognizant of what she can do, and it's her responsibility to tell her boss or her supervisor, I am too tired. I cannot think any longer. I cannot do this overtime. Because what happens is the nurses want to be good soldiers, so to speak, go in and take care of the patients. They're tired and everything. You have increased, there's evidence-based practice and articles, and there's also other research articles that says that when you're more tired, you make more mistakes. And so patient care is at risk. I personally would not want anyone taking care of me if they worked a 12-hour shift or any time over a 12-hour shift. When you work those 16-hour shifts, you know, you're impaired. But you have to be the one to tell those people, I am not able to do this. It's not safe for patient care.
We know in the Bureau of Prisons, for correctional officers, understaffing literally is a life and death safety issue. Do you feel that similar sentiment when we're talking about understaffing of nurses really becoming a life and death safety issue because of the patient care involved?
Absolutely. Would you want your father or your mother to have a nurse that had 10 or 15 patients and she missed something or he missed something and your loved one die? Absolutely.
Shiloh, if you can, tell us a little bit about what it's like working in your facility.
My facility is a rehab facility, and we have 500 inpatients, and the unit that I work on is the infirmary. And so currently we have, you know, we staff 24/7. And there are many times where what Lisa is talking about, where people do have to work 16-hour shifts, or other times where you have to change shifts multiple times in 1 week to cover the staffing. And you want to provide the best care for the veterans. So somebody's got to be there. And when you know that the options are limited, most nurses will be there.
What you're doing here, like all federal employees, is very meaningful work. What kind of pride do you take in what you do serving people at your facility?
The satisfaction of the veterans receiving the care at the facility and knowing what they've done for our country and being able to provide an excellent service to the veterans that may not otherwise have any health care or anywhere to go.
Do you find that they are appreciative of what you're doing for them and the care that you're giving them?
Absolutely. They are so appreciative. And as nurses, we do have high satisfaction because most of us working there are really passionate about what we are doing.
Now, I know that it's still early for you in terms of your involvement with the steering committee, but what are some of your goals as a younger, new member of the committee?
Well, some of my goals will to be an effective member of this committee, to get our voice as a whole to be heard about the issues that are going on that negatively impact our working environment, because the passion that we have about our jobs in a positive way does need to continue. And when it's working conditions change in a negative way, then the care that we provide it's hindered in ways.
Now, Lisa, we had talked a little bit before the program about the committee and some of the things that are happening. And one of the things that you mentioned to me was the need to really have more involvement from younger people, have younger people appointed to the committee to help out and sort of lend some expertise. Talk about the importance of that.
What we need in the Federation is more younger people to become involved. Just like in nursing, most of the committee members, we are looking at retirement age. A couple are retired, but they're very active. And we need younger nurses to get involved in the nurses' issues across the United States and in the VA and become aware of what's going on. Like Shiloh mentioned a while ago, most of the nurses don't realize. I was that way, too. I came to a LEDGE conference in Washington, and J. David Cox was telling us about being able to testify before the National Commission on VA Nurses, and I thought that was a wonderful opportunity. And that's what it took for me to get involved. And so what we need is with local presidents to bring their young to AFGE so they can learn the ropes and then be appointed to committees and also mentor them. I told Shiloh this morning she's going to have a lot of mentors because she's new, and we're going to help mentor her in this role that she's going to take on. And it's one of the most rewarding roles that you can have being appointed to this committee because you are affecting change in the federal workplace.
And one day she will become a mentor herself to someone else on this committee of 12 people chaired by NVP Nygaard. How important is that for her to really learn the way things are done now at an early age?
It is very important for her to learn the ropes. Instead of so many times people come and they don't have that mentorship and they don't know what they're doing. And so she is very fortunate, I think. And I think it's an honor for her to be appointed to this committee by her NVP. And I'm going to tell you, she just picked right up. And like she's always been there. And we realized, and she's realized, that the issues that we have and that we've been discussing, she had good insight on them because she's experiencing the same thing.
Going forward now in 2012, what's your top priority on the committee?
The top priority on the committee, we are still establishing our agenda. But I will tell you this, one of the most important priorities is to get full collective bargaining right for the VA nurses for Title 38. That 5 U.S.C. 7422 restricts us the right to bargain over professional conduct, competency, peer review, and compensation. And we happen to have a bill on the Hill now that we are trying to get co-sponsors on. The bill is H.R. 801 and S-572. It will be addressing some of the compensation issues. The problem that we're having, and what NVP Nygaard told us, that some of the people that co-sponsored the bill last year will not co-sponsor this year. So for the LEDGE conference, I'm sure that will be one of the top priorities that we have, and safe staffing levels. H.R. 2187 is the safe staffing bill that we're going to be pushing, and it includes all federal nurses, just not VA. Because like we've talked about, your staffing levels and your nurse-to-patient ratio, the less that you have patients assigned to nurses, the safer patient care will be.
Lisa Hartman and Shiloh Schalk, members of AFGE's Nursing Steering Committee, representatives from the 5th and 11th District, thank you for your time and the work that you do on behalf of all federal nurses. Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals Chairman Stan Painter,
Defense Conference Chair Don Hale and Vice Chair Patty Viers, AFGE Nurses Steering Committee members Lisa Hartman and Shiloh Schalk, and First Command Financial Services District Advisor Bob Hill. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government.